Turner.
I don't think he's trying very hard.
No, he's not. He's not got a lot to work with. But seriously, your voice means the world to a lot of people in this benighted country. So keep doing it.
Thank you.
And also your book, War Talk. We will plug that.
Okay.
Now, you don't remember, but actually, I did one of the very first interviews with you on A God of Small Things.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In Boston.
In Boston, at WBUR. And we also did a program on dams.
Okay. Yes, I remember that.
And I referred to you as a dam activist, and it was hard. It's a hard phrase to get used to, a dam activist. But we talked about Kerala. And in fact, a good friend of mine, George Matthew, went to your mother's school, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, George Matthew, who lives in India?
No, he lives in New York now. He's a conductor.
Oh, okay.
Very gifted musician, but...
Okay.
But anyway, here's the thing. We have done a series of hours on globalization, what's good and bad about, or elements of global culture, global commerce, global... technology, global medicine, blah, 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 that are pulling the world together, and the many other globalizations that are tearing the world apart. And this is a program we're going to do on Sunday, and I want to hear you with, you know, as they say, with the bark on. I want to hear your take on this new world and the new meaning of globalization, especially after Iraq. I want to know how the world should understand it and what the world is going to do about it. And I'm hoping very much that you can cut through this kind of bubble of American self-congratulation and, you know, we won, we're number one kind of thinking. So I want you to speak for all the women in the world, all the Indians in the world, all...
Oh, that's a bit difficult, but, you know, well, I'll try my best to at least speak for myself.
Yeah, good.
But,
good.
Yeah.
Yes, Ray, hang on one sec. Okay. I should one more thing, Ms. Roy. Neil Ferguson, you know him and his book on empire.
I haven't read it actually, to be honest. But yeah,
well,
I know
it was a BBC series. I mean, he's sort of he will have been on this program before you, and so I will ask you to speak to that kind of selling. A new version of empire or the old version of empire. And I'd also love you to talk about what we call the I word, imperialism. But shall we just plunge?
Yeah. How long will you take, Chris? Because, how long do you think?
I think you and I should talk now for about 20 minutes or half an hour.
That'll be like, you see, because I told Anthony, actually, that, you know, I needed you to call me at 8. Because, you know...
We've been trying. It's been hard to get through.
Oh, really? Because I actually I'm in South Africa right now, and I have an appointment.
Well, let's just get busy, and we'll make it as intense as you can.
Okay.
Don't save anything, and we'll try to do it promptly.
Okay.
Arundhati Roy, I'd love you to speak for the world beyond our shores, beyond Europe. What does the wider world make of this rather hard military edge of American superpower dominion in the world?
Well, I suppose, you know, that the argument that is being made now, of course, is that those countries that the United States needs to prize open its markets or its natural resources for this project of corporate globalization, if they don't succumb by the normal route of, you know, the IMF and the World Bank and so on, then they will be attacked militarily, and some excuse or the other will be found for that. And the fact is that people do know in realistic ways that American military might cannot be challenged formally. You know, no country in the world can challenge the American war machine formally. So what remains, I guess, is to challenge it in other ways. And of course, the whole project of corporate globalization itself, which is what the war is all about in the end. You know, as we have seen in the war against Iraq, it's so clear that the American army says, occupying force says, that it doesn't have orders to, you know, to do anything for the security of the Iraqi people. It doesn't have orders to secure the museum of, you know, ancient Mesopotamian civilization. But before the war even began, it had orders to secure the oil fields. You know, so you know what the priorities are here.
Well, how would you prove? I mean, or I shouldn't put it that way. How does the world understand what happened? Or put it this way.
In Iraq?
Yes. I mean, there were many reasons given for the war, weapons of mass destruction, you know, yeah. The beastly regime of Saddam Hussein. Why do you focus exclusively on corporate globalization? And do you think...
Well, because, you see, these excuses that are given are exactly that. They are excuses. And nobody seriously... you know, of course, the point is that there is the hypnotic effect of the mass media, you know. So, of course, there are many people, and particularly in America, there are many people who feel that, oh, you know, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is a covert member of the Al-Qaeda. And, you know, Saddam Hussein is a dictator and so on. But this is a spin that I'd say, you know, outside of... Europe, in some places, and America, nobody even entertains seriously. Hmm. And, you know, nobody, you know, things have unfolded, it looks so obvious that it was just ridiculous. And the fact that Saddam Hussein was installed and supported and supplied militarily and otherwise by America in the past, the fact that, you know, the Shah of Iran had been supported in that dictatorship for years and years, the fact that, the U.S. government has, of course, I think, toppled more democracies and installed more dictatorships than anybody else ever. So the point is that one is now even bored to some extent of the litany of sins of the American empire, you know. It's there. And as far as I'm concerned, now those who want to believe it will continue to believe what they want to believe. Mm. And those who know the facts, know what's actually going on. And the issue is, how do we deal with it? You know,
that's the question.
What do people do?
You've written about confronting empire. How does the world confront empire, especially when there's no possibility of challenging the U.S. militarily?
Well, when I wrote Confronting Empire, you know, the huge marches against the Iraq war had started, but had not, obviously, the February 15th, you know, massive show of international people's morality somehow had not happened yet. And I think that we, you know, what happened is that empire was forced to go to war stark naked. You know, the halo was toppled. Mm. So what we did was, yes, Iraq was crushed, but it was crushed on our terms. It was crushed in, you know, by empire in all its naked brutality. And that is a kind of victory. You know, it's not a victory, but it is a very important thing that happened. Now, I think what is happening in the world is that it is becoming obvious that you cannot confront the American military machine. So what do you confront? You confront the economic outpost of the American empire. And I think you'll see a lot of that. You
know, what does that mean?
It means that, you know, symbolic resistance, these marches and so on, will become symbolic. So far, they were the substance of the resistance. But now you'll see real civil disobedience, as in, you know, almost like people sanctions, reversing the sanctions that were, say, put on a country like Iraq. But reversing those sanctions, and you know, there are lots of places where now American goods are, you know, being boycotted, and you know that whole thing is going to be real civil disobedience as opposed to the theater of resistance now.
What does the man on the street in India make of all this?
Well, in India, I don't think I've spoken to a single person, and I speak to people from every kind of, you know, rural, urban, every class and caste. I haven't really come across anybody, except certain, you know, there are some sort of very opportunistic, you know, conclaves. But other than that, nobody is under any illusions about what's going on, you know, nobody.
But how would they put it? How would they describe what's going on?
They would just describe it as you know, racism in a way, I think, you know, that it is eventually being seen as a racist war, and as imperialism, of course, you know, as an occupation, as an illegal occupation, as bullying, and of course this utterly despicable fact of, you know, even though yes, members of the Security Council voted against the war and so on, but really they colluded to disarm a country and then allow America to attack it. It is, I don't know that there's been such a war ever in the history of the world, you know, where you use diplomacy to make an already poor country disarm. You use sanctions to crush the people, to break the infrastructure, to make sure they have nothing there, and then say they have weapons of mass destruction and attack them. It's an act of cowardice that's hard to hold in the imagination, you know. And people see that. People see, ultimately, everybody's, you know, I mean, Even before this, you know, person who's been convicted for embezzlement, whatever his name is, Chalabi, they're trying to install this democracy. But before they install the democracy, they must make sure that all the tax laws are rewritten, the patent laws are rewritten, the oil fields are secured and privatized. Then what is democracy? It doesn't matter because all the main issues have been settled already.
The historian Neil Ferguson, on this program, but in big book form and on the BBC, has been urging the United States to take up where Britain and the British Empire left off, take up the white man's burden, he says in so many words, and celebrate what's good about empire. My question is whether the world is ready to accept that the United States in that old role.
The urging of America to take over where the British left off is a bit outdated because they've done that already a long time ago. They started, and the American Empire is morphed from the British Empire, you know, and it's a sort of obnoxious call as far as I'm concerned, you know, and all of us are concerned. And you know, if it were made, it depends on who you're talking to. Obviously, if you're going to say whisper that in the ear of George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, they're going to puff their chests out and thump them, you know. But to everybody else, to all of us who are people from ex-colonies, what do you expect us to say or think about that? Where are you going to find a person from an ex-colony saying, "Oh, empire was wonderful for us. It was so lovely that, you know, in 1874, millions of Indians died of drought while food was being exported to England. It was so wonderful, wasn't it?"
Well, the Irish remember that too.
Our languages and civilizations were broken and, you know, apartheid was wonderful in South Africa. Are we going to say that?
Well, that seems to be the question ever since 9/11. There has been this kind of neo-imperial impulse in the Bush regime, confronting 40, 50 years of a flawed but cheerful post-colonial sensibility in most of the world. How does that sort of post-colonial spirit re-energize itself in these days?
You know, I think what you're seeing now is what you did see in the imperial past, which is that, like, say, when Britain had colonized India, of course, the Indian elite colluded in that colonization.
Yes.
You know, it could not have otherwise succeeded in that project. So now, you know, as I keep saying, the white man doesn't need to come to the jungles and risk malaria and diarrhea and an early death, not even few of them, you know, because because they have their agents, their local agents, you know, putting down civil unrest for them. They have their agents everywhere, in South Africa, in India, in every country that's allowing its markets to be opened. You know, in India, because it's open to the corporate globalization project, it doesn't matter that the democratic Indian government massacred 2,000 Muslims on the streets of Gujarat last year. It doesn't matter because the markets are open. But if the markets weren't open, then it would matter. You know, then we would be told that, oh, we need to bomb you because this is a terrible thing you did to Muslims. So, you know, there's a new language that's been spoken now. And this language of quick fix democracy, you know, the Marines are out in Afghanistan on a feminist mission. In Iraq, you know, we are installing democracy. It's you know, what do you expect us to think, you know? I mean, people of an average intelligence.
Well, we wanted to speak up. I mean, there are a lot of people even in this country who agree with you much more than with President Bush. And I think we do want to hear the post-colonial spirit get up on its hind legs and talk back.
Yeah. No, it is. The point is that, you know, if people are going to be bombed and napalmed out of their opinions, then there isn't, you know, I mean, then the talking back happens in different ways, you know. Mm. So say you look at a country like India just now, the whole process of this war on terror and these bills on terrorism, what is happening is a telescoping of the definition of what is a terrorist. In India today, a poor person is a terrorist. Hmm. There are thousands of poor people in India in jail who have been told that they are terrorists, but actually they're protesting against development projects brought in by corporate globalization. You know, they're protesting being pushed off their lands and pushed off their jobs and having no water and cut off from the natural resources, but they are being booked under the Terrorism Act. So the fact is that, you know, we need to ally, as I have written. I know that there are people who share our opinions in America, and I keep talking about this here. What is this anti-American business? Because we need to ally with those people who are out on the streets there who understand these things. You know, they are our friends. And there are people who are much more dangerous to us in our own government who are the allies of Mr. Bush, you know. So we can't even think in these nationalistic terms anymore.
Well, exactly. This is the sort of the hope of the other side of globalism. I mean, you're a global writer. This is a global technology that we're speaking on. The internet is a fantastic medium for democratic communication around the whole planet. I mean, what is your remaining hope for the bomb of globalization, medicine and technology and culture?
You know, I'm often labeled quite carelessly as an anti-globalization activist, and I keep trying to say, no, I'm not anti-globalization, because I'm for the globalization of international justice and nuclear treaties and chemical weapons and human rights treaties. And what is contested is only what should be globalized and what should not be, you know. And eventually, I think that you know, to put it in conceptual terms, let's say, what I keep saying is that in developing countries, already because of the pressure of poverty and the legacy of colonialism, you had a situation where, even in a democratic country like India, you had a huge distance between people who made decisions and people who had to suffer those decisions. Because, you know, somebody in Kerala had to eventually look to the government in Delhi or the Supreme Court in Delhi, which is a big, you know, physical as well as political distance, social distance. And then corporate globalization comes along and increases that distance. you know, now you got to go to Berlin or Washington or to wherever the World Bank or Wolfensohn is hanging out, you know. And what we seek to do is to eliminate that distance, you know, ultimately to eliminate the distance between those who take decisions and those who have to suffer them. And on the other hand, to remove the isolation of our traditional past, you know, of the remote Indian village where caste and cruelty and absolute cruelty towards women is practiced by the globalization of resistance, by us being able to be, in, you know, sort of turn it inside out, more or less, if you like, you know, by solidarity between people who are struggling for social justice.
What is the chance, Arundhati Roy, that the things we like about globalization, including culture, including the sense of ourselves as one species, can prevail against all the power and financial advantage and alienation that can also come out of globalization?
Look, I mean, there isn't any way of my answering that in any kind of mathematical sense. But right now, since I'm talking to an audience in America, I want to say this, that the only institution that is more powerful than the American government is the people of America. And they have a lot of responsibility riding on their shoulders. And I know that in the past they have prevailed on their governments to pull out of the most bestial acts. And really, they must do that now. They must rise up and do that now. Because they cannot sit back and watch what is being done to the world and sleep with clean consciences or clear consciences, you know. It is incumbent on them to do something.
What would you like them to do?
Well, you know, what they did to force their government to stop the war in Vietnam, you know, what they did in, you know, those are the kinds of things that they must do. They must use their vote to vote this man out of power. Even if, you know, people say, oh, the Democrats and the Republicans are the same. I think there is some difference, you know. And this coterie is dangerous, close to insane, what they are doing.
How can they use sort of the devices of globalization, including the internet, including sort of global conscience? I mean, what are the global tools at hand?
I think, you know, quite simply what we need to do is now, let's say in terms of civil disobedience, in terms of economic boycotts, we need to simplify, to make, let's say, a hit list, you know, of what needs to be assassinated.
What's
in
on it?
Economic terms.
What's
I'm
on the list?
Talking about. Huh?
What's on the list?
I don't know. I'm suggesting it conceptually, you know, that you need to single out targets and you need to deal with them one by one, you know?
Give us your top three.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I would have said Enron, but luckily Enron is out now. But let's say, you know, big corporate companies that are taking over water and electricity and things like that in developing countries like Bechtel and GE, and, you know, it's not just the Coke, Pepsi, Nike, McDonald's. You know, those are the consumer items. But we want, you know, in third world countries, those are not our only enemies. You know, they are, it's the water we drink and the air we breathe and the lights we switch on. Everything is being taken over. So, you know, I think we need to, I mean, you know, it's not that one person needs to put out this list, but I think activists are doing that across the world. You know, they are making out these lists. And then you have to go after these people because, you know, look at the, you know, who are the companies that are taking over. For instance, let's say the oil of Iraq, they must be targeted. You know, they must not be allowed to have been instrumental in this process of yes, Saddam Hussein is a dictator, but he was supported and set up by this very government that is paying for his blood now. But the sanctions against Iraq killed hundreds of thousands of people. You know, that blood is on someone's hands. You know, plus what plus the destruction of the entire country, and then cold-bloodedly talking about now the reconstruction of Iraq will kickstart the world economy. You know, it's murder. It's murder. And surely, if it's all right to use a preemptive strike and to directly target and assassinate Saddam Hussein without a military military trial, at least those who supported him and supplied him with arms at the time, at the height of his mass killings, at least they should be tried as war criminals. And those people are members of the United States government and the UK government.
Last question for me. Where you travel, and especially in India, do you find that these ideas are, your ideas are popular and get a following? Do they have to be explained?
No, they don't have to be explained. You know, in fact, I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, a few years ago when I started writing about privatization and corporate globalization, I used to take so much flack, you know. I used to get hit all the time, and now it's just accepted, you know, because not I'm just not talking about myself, but what I mean is people in countries like India have seen it unfold before their eyes. They know, you know, what's happening. You know, if I, like I spoke here in South Africa last night to a large audience, it isn't that we even began to debate what the American Empire was doing or what the results of the corporate globalization project was. You know, those were accepted. It was like, let's go from here now. You know, let's not even bother with, you know, listing the sins of empire, because we all know what they are.
You're marvelous. You're marvelous. And I'm very, very grateful to you. You know, we've been chasing you for weeks, it seems like, and I'm so glad we caught up. When are you coming back to the States?
I'm coming there on, you know, I'm speaking at that Riverside Church in Harlem on the 13th of May.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll be around for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks maybe.
I'm told that event is already sold out, but we're going to try to catch up with you. But this has been great, and just keep doing what you're doing. You're an important beacon in the world, believe me.
Okay. You take care.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.